వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సభప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా. శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి. అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Shri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday, on the 18th of June 2020, and with me, Team Radio Sai Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment, Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashanti Nilayam. Let me first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. Why does the formless absolute manifest in the world? Bhagwan lovingly reveals to us today and also hints at how to utilize this opportunity. And I quote, "The growing crop in the fields thirsts for rain. It sees the heavy rain clouds sail across the sky, but it cannot rise to that altitude and drink the self-giving rain, the life-giving rain, sorry. Nor can it bring the clouds down to the ground. Humanity too sizzles in the hot sun, the unbearable heat of ego and greed. It needs the rain of grace. It knows only then can flourish in peace and joy. Just as the clouds form droplets and fall upon the fields that they choose to foster, the formless absolute individualizes itself, assumes form, and comes down in the midst of humanity to save and sustain. That is the secret of God or Madhava coming down as man, Manava. The cloud taking pity on the crop, parching in the sun. Once the rains come, the sun has its uses. So too, when the grace of the Lord is gained, ego and greed can be put to profit by being made to flow into useful channels." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on January 25th, 1963. Dear listener, today as the world is continuing with lockdowns and social distancing due to the spread of the coronavirus disease or the COVID-19, let us all continue to take all the precautions mandated by the government and the health department, and also maintain personal and community hygiene. And also, let us continue to engage in prayers at our own places for world peace. Talking about prayers, let me now play for you the mantra or the verse from the Krishna Yajurveda Taittiriya Aranyaka. The potency of this mantra is in destroying all the harmful germs and viruses. And here it is.
Om Atrinatva Krime Hanmi Kanvena Jamadagnina Vishvavaso Brahmana Hataha Krimina Gumraja Apyesha Vistapatir Hataha Atho Mata Atho Pita Atho Sthura Atho Kshudra Atho Krishna Atho Shveta Atho Ashatika Hata Shveta Bhissaha Sarve Hata Ahara Vadya Shrutasya Havisho Yata Tat Satyam Yadamuyamasya Jambhayo Adadami Tatahitat Khantan Rasi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Dear listener, this mantra is chanted daily in the morning and evening during the Mandir prayer sessions here at Prashanti Nilayam. And for those of you who don't know, let me tell you that these prayer sessions are streamed live for all to listen on Radio Sai's Prashanti Mandir live YouTube channel, Sri Satya Sai Baba Facebook page, and of course Radio Sai's Asia stream and Telugu stream, both in the morning at 8 a.m. and in the evening at 5 p.m. So you could log on at these times. The time right now in our studios is 51 minutes past 9 a.m. that is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I've lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemadpant, followed by the second part of an interview from our archives with Dr. Valluvan Jeevanandam, recorded in the year 2005. In conversation with him is Professor G. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning and also the former Director of Radio Sai. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemad Pant. We are thankful to Srimati Vasanti Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Sri Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and a blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Praying to Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus disease be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. Samasta Lokaha Sukhino Bhavantu.
Chapter 34, Greatness of Bodhi, continued from the last chapter. Doctor's nephew, Dr. Pillai, Shama's sister-in-law, Irani girl, Harda gentleman, Mumbai lady. This chapter continues the subject Greatness of Bodhi and describes cases in which the application of Bodhi was most efficacious. Doctor's nephew. In Malegaon, there lived a doctor. His nephew suffered from an incurable disease, tubercular bone abscess. The doctor, along with his relatives and medical practitioners, tried all sorts of remedies and even a surgery. There was no relief and no end to the little boy's suffering. Friends and relatives advised the parents of the boy to seek divine aid and recommended them to go to Sai Baba, who was known to have cured such incurable cases by his mere glance. The parents therefore came to Shirdi. They prostrated themselves before Baba, placed the boy before him, and pleaded humbly and implored him to save their son. The merciful Baba comforted them, saying, "Those who resort to this masjid shall never suffer anything in this life to the end of time, Now do not worry. Apply Udi on the abscess and within a week he will recover. Believe in God. This is no masjid, but Dwarka Mai. He who steps here will soon get health and happiness, and his sufferings will come to an end. The boy was made to sit before Baba, who moved his hands on the affected part and cast his loving glances on him. The patient was pleased, and with the application of the Udi, he began to recover and was all right after some days. The parents then left Shirdi with their son, thanking Baba for the cure which was effected by Udi and Baba's gracious looks. After knowing this, the doctor, the uncle of the boy, became wonderstruck and desired to see Baba while he was on his way to Mumbai for some business. At Maligaon in Manmad, somebody spoke to him against Baba and poisoned his ears. Therefore, he dropped the idea of visiting Shirdi and went to Mumbai direct. He wanted to spend the rest of his leave at Ali Bagh, but at Mumbai he heard three successive nights a voice saying, "Still, do you disbelieve me?" Then the doctor changed his mind and resolved to go to Shirdi. He had to attend to a case of infectious fever in Mumbai, which showed no signs of quick abatement. So he thought that a Shirdi trip would be postponed. However, he proposed a test in his mind and said, "If the patient gets all right by today, I will start for Shirdi tomorrow." The wonder is that, exactly from the time when the determination was done, the fever began to abate and the temperature became normal. Then he went to Shirdi as per his decision and took Baba's darshan and prostrated himself before him. Baba gave him such experiences that he became his devotee. He stayed there for 4 days and returned home with Baba's udi and blessings. Within a fortnight, he was transferred in promotion to Bijapur. His nephew's case gave him an opportunity for seeing Baba, and this visit garnered in him a never-failing love for the saint's feet. Dr. Pillai. One Dr. Pillai was an intimate devotee of Baba. He was much liked by Baba, who always called him Bhau or brother. Baba talked to him off and on and consulted him in all matters and wanted him always to be at his side. This Pillai suffered once very badly from guinea worms. He said to Kaka Sahib Dixit, "The pain is most excruciating and unbearable. I prefer death to it. This pain I know is for repaying past karma. But go to Baba and tell him to cease the pain and transfer the balance of my past karma to 10 future births of mine." Mr. Dixit went to Baba and told him his request. Then Baba, being moved by his request, said to Dixit, "Tell him to be fearless. Why should he suffer for 10 births? In 10 days he can work out the sufferings and consequences of his past karma. While I am here to give him temporal and spiritual welfare, why should he pray for death? Bring him here on somebody's back and let us work and finish his sufferings once for all." The doctor was brought in that condition and was seated on Baba's right side. Baba gave him his bolster and said, "Lie down calmly here and be at ease. The true remedy is that the result of past actions has to be suffered and got over. Our karma is the cause of our happiness and sorrow. Therefore, put up with whatever comes to you. Allah is the sole dispenser and protector. Think of Him always. He will take care of you. Surrender to Him with body, mind and speech, and then see what He does." Dr. Pillai said, Nana Sahib had put a bandage over the leg, but he had no relief. "Oh, Nana is a fool," said Baba. "Take off the bandage or else you will die. Now a crow will come and peck at you and then you will recover." While this conversation was going on, Abdul, who always cleaned the masjid and trimmed the lamps, turned up. While he was attending to his work, his foot accidentally fell upon the stretched leg of Dr. Pillai. The leg was already swollen, and when Abdul's foot fell upon it and pressed it, all the 7 guinea worms were squeezed out at once. The pain was unbearable and Dr. Pillai cried out loudly. After some time, he calmed down and began to sing and cry alternately. Then Pillai inquired when the crow was coming and pecking. Baba said, "Did you not see the crow? He won't come again. Abdul was the crow. Now go and rest in the wada. and you will be soon all right. By application of the udi and by taking it orally with water, without taking any other treatment or medicine, the disease was completely cured in 10 days, as assured by Baba. Shama's sister-in-law. Shama's younger brother, Bapaji, was staying near the Savli well. Once his wife was attacked with bubonic plague. She had high fever and two buboes in her groin. Bapaji rushed to Shama at Shirdi and asked him to come and help. Shama was frightened, but according to his custom, he went to Baba, prostrated himself before him to invoke his aid by requesting him to cure the case. He also asked his permission to go to his brother's house. Baba said, "Do not go there at this late hour. Send her the udi. Why care for the fever and buboes? God is her father. She will be all right easily. Do not go now. Go there in the morning and return immediately." Shama had full faith in Baba's udi. It was sent with Bapaji. It was applied on the buboes and some of it was mixed with water given to the patient for drinking. No sooner was it taken in, perspiration set in profusely, the fever abated and the patient had a sound sleep. Next morning, Bapaji was surprised to see his wife all right, with no fever and no buboes. When Shama went there next morning with Baba's permission, he was also surprised to see her in the kitchen preparing tea. On questioning his brother, he learnt that Baba's udi cured her completely in one night. Then Shama realized the significance of Baba's words, "Go there in the morning and return immediately." After taking tea, Shama returned and after saluting Baba said, "Deva, what is this play of yours? You first raise a storm and make us restless and then calm it down and comfort us." Baba replied, "You see, mysterious is the path of action. Though I do nothing, they hold me responsible for the actions which take place on account of destiny. I am only their witness. The Lord is the sole doer and inspirer. He is most merciful. Neither I am God nor master. I am his obedient servant and remember him constantly. He who casts aside his egoism and thanks him, and he who trusts him entirely, will have his shackles removed and will obtain liberation." Irani's daughter. Now read the experience of an Irani gentleman. His young daughter got fits every hour. When the convulsions came, she lost her power of speech, her limbs contracted, and she fell down senseless. No remedy gave her any relief. Some friend recommended Baba's udi to her father and asked him to get it from Kaka Sahib Dikshit at Viliparla. Then the Irani gentleman got the udi and gave it mixed with water to his daughter daily for drinking. In the beginning, the convulsions which were coming hourly came every 7 hours. And after a few days, the daughter recovered completely. Harda gentleman. An old gentleman of Harda was suffering from a stone in his kidney. Such stones are generally removed by surgical operations and people recommended him to undergo one. He was old and weak, lacked strength of mind and could not think of submitting himself to surgical treatment. His suffering was soon to end in another way. The Inamdar of that town happened to come there at that time. He was a devotee of Baba and always had a stock of udi with him. On the recommendation of friends, his son got some udi from him and after mixing it with water, gave it to his old father to drink. Within 5 minutes, the udi was assimilated, the stone was dissolved and came out through the urine, and the old man was soon relieved. Mumbai lady. A woman of the Kaivs Prabhu caste in Mumbai always suffered terrible pain at her delivery. She was very much frightened each time she got pregnant and did not know what to do. Sri Ramamurthy of Kalyan, who was a devotee of Baba, advised her husband to take her to Shirdi. When she next became pregnant, both husband and wife came to Shirdi, stayed there for some months and worshipped Baba. After some time, the hour of delivery came and as usual, there was obstruction in the passage from the womb. She began to suffer labor pains, did not know what to do, but began to pray to Baba for relief. In the meantime, some neighboring women turned up and, after invoking Baba's aid, gave a udi mixture to drink. In 5 minutes, the woman delivered safely and painlessly. The issue was still born according to its fate, but the mother, who got rid of the anxiety and pain, thanked Baba for the safe delivery and ever remained grateful to him. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 35. Tested and never found wanting. Kaka Mahajani's friend and master. Bandra insomnia case. Bala Patil Nevaskar. This chapter also continues the subject of the importance and effectiveness of the Udi. It also gives two cases in which Baba was tested and not found wanting. These cases will be taken up first. Preliminary. In spiritual matters or endeavors, sectarianism is the greatest bar to our progress. Those who believe that God is without form are heard saying that to believe that God is with form is an illusion, and that saints are only human beings. Then why should they bow down their heads before them and offer dakshina? Persons belonging to other sects will also raise objections and say, why should they bow and offer allegiance to other saints, leaving their own gurus? Similar objections regarding Sai Baba were heard before and even now. Some said, when they went to Shirdi, Baba asked for dakshina from them. Is it good that saints should collect money in this fashion? If they do, where is their sainthood? But there are many instances where men went to Shirdi to scoff, but remained there to pray. Two such instances are given below. Kaka Mahajani's friend. A friend of Kaka Mahajani was a worshipper of Nirgun, God without form. He was averse to idolatry. Out of curiosity, he agreed to go to Shirdi with Kaka Mahajani on two conditions: that he would neither bow down to Baba nor pay him any dakshina. Kaka agreed to these conditions, and they both left Mumbai on a Saturday night and reached Shirdi the next morning. As soon as they put their feet on the steps of the masjid, Baba, looking at the friend from a little distance, addressed him in sweet words as follows: "Oh, welcome, sir." The tone in which he uttered these words was a very peculiar one. It exactly resembled the tone of the friend's father. It reminded him of his departed father and sent a thrill through his body. What an enchanting power the tone had. Being surprised, the friend said, "This is no doubt the voice of my father." Then he at once went up and, forgetting his resolution, placed his head upon Baba's feet. Then Baba asked for dakshina twice, once in the morning and again at noon, at the time of the taking leave. But he asked it from Kaka only and not from the friend. The latter whispered to Kaka, "Baba asked for dakshina from you twice. I am with you. Why does he ignore me?" "You asked Baba yourself," was Kaka's reply. Baba asked Kaka what his friend was whispering. Then the friend asked Baba himself whether he should pay any dakshina. Baba replied, "You had no mind to pay, so you were not asked. But if you want to pay now, you may." Then the friend paid 17 rupees as dakshina, the same amount that Kaka paid. Baba then addressed a few words of advice. "You destroyed the Teli's wall, sense of difference between us, so that we can see and meet each other face to face." Then Baba allowed them to leave. Though the weather was cloudy and rough, Baba assured them of their safe journey, and both of them reached Mumbai safely. When he reached home and opened the door and the windows of his house, he found two sparrows dead on the ground and one just flying out through a window. He thought if he had left the windows open, two sparrows would have been saved, but thought again that they had met their lot and that Baba had sent him back soon just to save the third sparrow. Kaka Mahajani's master. Kaka was a manager in the firm of Thakkar Dharmase Jethabhai, a solicitor of Mumbai. Both the master and the manager were on intimate terms. Mr. Thakkar knew that Kaka was often going to Shirdi, staying there for some days and returning when Baba permitted him. Out of curiosity, Mr. Thakkar decided to go to Shirdi with Kaka during the Shimga holidays. As Kaka's return was uncertain, he took another man with him for his company. The three started together and Kaka bought 2 sears of raisins on the way for presentation to Baba. They reached Shirdi in due time and went to the masjid for darshan. Baba Sahib Tarkhat was also there and Mr. Thakkar asked him why he came there. For darshan, Tarkhat replied. Mr. Thakkar asked if miracles took place there. Tarkhat replied, miracles was not the concern. The earnest intentions of the bhaktas were satisfied there. Then Kaka prostrated himself before Baba and offered the raisins to him. Baba ordered them to be distributed. Mr. Thakkar also got a few of them. He did not want to have the raisins as he was advised by his doctor not to eat them without washing and cleaning them. So he was in a fix. He did not want to eat them nor could he reject them. To keep up formalities, he put them into his mouth but did not know what to do with the seeds. He could not spit them out on the floor of the masjid, so he pocketed them against his wish. He then said in his mind that if Baba was a saint, how could he be ignorant of his dislike for the raisins and how could he force them on him? When this thought arose in his mind, Baba again gave him some more raisins. He could not eat them but held them in his hand. Then Baba asked him to eat them up. He obeyed and found to his surprise that they were all seedless. He wanted to see miracles and here was one. He knew that Baba read his thought and asked for his wish, converted raisins with seeds into seedless grapes. What a wonderful power. Again, to test further, he asked Tarkhat, who was sitting by and who also got some raisins, what kind of grapes did you get? Tarkhat replied, the variety with seeds. Mr. Thakkar was still more surprised to hear this. Then to confirm his faith further, Thakkar thought in his mind that if Baba was a real saint, the raisins should be now given to Kaka first. Reading this thought also, Baba ordered that distribution should be commenced from Kaka. These proofs were sufficient for Thakkar. Then Shama introduced Mr. Thakkar as a master of Kaka, upon which Baba said, how could he be his master? He has got a different master altogether. Kaka appreciated this reply. After forgetting his resolve, Thakkar saluted Baba and returned to the Vada. After the noon aarti was over, they all went to the masjid for taking Baba's leave for their departure. Shama spoke for them. Baba then spoke as follows. There was a fickle-minded gentleman. He had health and wealth and was free from physical and mental afflictions. But he took on needless anxieties and burdens and wandered hither and thither, thus losing his peace of mind. Sometimes he dropped the burdens and at other times carried them again. His mind knew no steadiness. On seeing his state, I took pity on him and said, now keep your faith on one place you like. Why roam like this? Thakkar at once understood this. This was an exact description of himself. He wished that Kaka should also return with him, but no one expected that Kaka would be allowed to leave Shirdi so soon. Baba read this thought also and permitted Kaka to return with his master. Then Baba asked Kaka for 15 rupees as dakshina and received it. He said, if I take 1 rupee as dakshina from anybody, I have to return tenfold to him. I never take anything gratis. I never ask anyone indiscriminately. I only ask and take from him whom the fakir points out. If anyone is indebted formally to the fakir, dakshina is received from him. The donor gives, that is, sows his seeds only to reap a rich harvest in future. Wealth should be the means to work out dharma. If it is used for personal enjoyment, it is wasted. Unless you have given it before, you do not get it now. So the best way to receive is to give. The giving of dakshina advances vairagya and thereby bhakti and dhyan. Give one and receive tenfold. On hearing these words, Mr. Tucker himself gave 15 rupees in Baba's hand, forgetting his earlier resolve not to do so. He thought it was good that he came to Shirdi, as all his doubts were solved and he learned so much. Baba's skill in handling such cases was unique. Though he conducted all that, he was totally non-attached to them. Whether anybody saluted him or not, or whether anybody gave him dakshina or not, all were same to him. He felt no pleasure if he was worshipped, and felt no pain if he was disregarded. He had transcended the powers of opposites, pleasure and pain. Insomnia case. A Kais Prabhu gentleman of Bandra suffered from insomnia for long. As soon as he lay down for sleep, his departed father appeared to him in his dream, abused and scolded him severely. This disturbed his sleep and made him restless the whole night. Every night this went on and the man did not know what to do. One day, he consulted a devotee of Baba in this respect. He recommended the udi as the only infallible remedy he knew. He gave him some of the udi and asked him to apply a little on his forehead before going to bed and keep the udi packet under the pillow. He tried this remedy and found, to his great surprise and joy, that he had a sound sleep and there was no disturbance of any kind. He continued the remedy and always remembered Sai. Then he got a picture of Sai Baba, which he hung on the wall near his pillow and started worshipping it daily, and on Thursdays he offered garland and Naivedya. Then he got well and forgot his trouble altogether. Balaji Patil Nivaskar. This man was a great devotee of Baba. He rendered excellent and selfless service. Every day he swept and kept clean all the passages and streets in Shirdi through which Baba passed in his daily routine. After him, this work was done equally well by another devotee, Radha Krishnamai, and after her by Abdullah. When Balaji reaped his corn every year, he brought the whole quantity and presented it to Baba. He returned with what Baba gave him back and maintained himself and his family with it. This course was followed by him for many years and after him by his son too. Power and efficacy of Udi. Once it happened that at Balaji's death anniversary, a certain number of guests were invited and the dinner was prepared for them. But at the dinner time, it was found that thrice the number of people invited had turned up. Mrs. Nivaskar was in a fix. She thought that the food would not be sufficient for the people assembled, and if it fell short, the honor of the family would be at stake. Her mother-in-law comforted her by saying, "Do not be afraid. It is not ours but Sai's food. Cover every vessel with cloth, putting some udi in it, and serve from the same without opening it. Sai will save us from ignominy." She did as she was advised, and it was found to their surprise and joy that not only did the food suffice for all, but plenty of it remained after serving. As one feels intently, so he realizes accordingly was proved in this case. Sai appearing as serpent. Once Raghu Patil of Shirdi went to Balaji Patil at Nivas. That evening he found that a serpent entered the cowshed hissing. All the cattle were afraid and became restless. The inmates of the house were frightened, but Balaji thought that it was Sai, who appeared in his house as a serpent. Without being afraid in the least, he brought a cup of milk and placing it before the serpent said, "Baba, why do you hiss like this? Do you want to frighten us? Take this cup of milk and drink it with a calm mind." Saying this, he sat down close by. The other members were frightened and did not know what to do. In a short time, the serpent disappeared of its own and nobody knew where it went. It was not found, though a thorough search was made in the cowshed. Balaji had two wives and some children. They sometimes went to Shirdi from Nivas for taking Baba's darshan. Then Baba brought saris and other clothes which were given to them with his blessings. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Dr. Jivanandam, welcome to the studios of Radio Sai. It's nice to see you back here, and this encourages me to hope that you will come here again and again and again and again. So how has life been treating you since you were last year in our studios?
Yeah, very good, sir.
Very good.
With Swami's grace, everything is good.
So any interesting things to talk about, experiences or otherwise? Because that's something our listeners lap up. And if I don't produce an experience out of you, I will get a lot of flack.
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is an experience that I talked about before, but you know, we had operated on a patient who actually came, and he had
in Chicago.
In Chicago, so he had two previous operations, mm-hmm. and he had had two valves done. And this
by
time,
you?
No, by somebody else. Mm. And this time he needed bypasses and the valve replaced. Mm. And so he had gone to several other hospitals, and they did not want to touch him because he was such a high-risk patient. So he came to us, and I said, okay, you're a high-risk patient. There's a chance you may die, but without this operation, he was basically homebound. I mean, he couldn't really do anything. So we started operating on him, and this was one of the most difficult cases I've ever done. And
how old was the patient?
He was 55, 60. And so I'm praying to Swami. I said, Swami, this is not going good. I mean, this is one of these few patients who we actually might lose on the table. And about ready to give up. I mean, this was just a very, very difficult operation, a lot of bleeding. And so one of our anesthesiologists walked into the room. And this anesthesiologist, you know, she's very touchy-feely with the patients, so she actually spends a fair amount of time with the patients. So she came in and she said, hey, listen, I want to tell you a story that this man said. You know, he's a little kooky, but I want to tell you a story. And, you know, we're struggling with the operation, and the last thing I wanted to hear was a story.
So, no surprise in that.
This anesthesiologist is somebody who won't, you know, be quiet. He just will talk anyway. So he said, okay, fine, say whatever you want. So he says, you know, this guy, so she's telling me about the patient. She says, this guy tells me the strangest story. He says that he was driving his car, mm-hmm. and his heart condition is so bad that his heart intermittently just stops. Mm-hmm. It has what's called fibrillation, mm-hmm. and then you have an internal cardioverter defibrillator, or something that shocks him.
Pacemaker.
It's like a pacemaker, except it's actually called a defibrillator.
Okay.
So as the heart stops, it just basically shocks it. You know, like on TV, you see the heart being shocked back. So he's driving, and his heart stops, and he actually faints. And he goes and crashes into a gas line, and the gas line explodes. Okay? And he tells the patient, and he tells the anesthesiologist, when the paramedics found him, somehow he was 250 feet away from where his car and the gas line was. His car was completely on fire.
He must have been wearing the seatbelt.
And he was wearing a seatbelt. Mm. And they were all, you know, everyone said, it's amazing, how did this happen? And he said, you know, I don't know, but a small guy came in, pulled me out of the car. And they turned around, and they saw a person there with an afro. And then when they came back to see if this was a good Samaritan and whether he needed any help or get his name, he was gone. And
you and I know who that was.
Absolutely. And so this gentleman then gets taken to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And in the emergency room, it just so happened that I had given a talk earlier, and I said to these people, if you have cases that appear to be, you know, inoperable, just send them to us. Mm-hmm. So he had gone to many hospitals and doctors and was kind of written off. So he goes
this
to
this accident was some time before the operation.
About 3 months before the operation. So he goes to this emergency room, and so this guy, this physician who happens to be there at that time says, hey, listen, you have a bad condition. Why don't you go see, you know, Dr. Jivanandam at the University of Chicago? So after, you know, Pat says this, I get like a, you know, it's like electricity going through my body. He said, if Swami has come and saved this guy before, then surely he will use me as an instrument and save him again. So, you know, kind of revigorated and re-energized to try to get this patient done. And eventually we got the patient done.
And she was telling you this story while you were struggling with the patient.
Exactly.
Maybe that was Swami telling you, don't worry, I'm here.
Absolutely. You know, everybody works through Swami. And so that patient actually, you know, remarkably did very, very well, and to the absolute surprise of everybody.
How is the patient now?
He's doing great. So he, you know, I related this story to other people, Swai devotees. And they said, why don't you do a test? you know, why don't you have, why don't you show him Swami's picture and see if he can recognize Swami's picture? You know, everybody wants to test Swami, right?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
So what I did was I invited him to my office. And in my office, we have Swami's pictures, you know, in the, you know, on my table, calendars and pictures like that. So I invited him in, and he looked at Swami's picture, and he said, you know, that person is very familiar. That person looks very similar to the person who pulled me out of the car. So there you go. Is that the ultimate story?
No, I'll give one more of this ultimate story if you want to hear.
Okay.
Ready?
Sure.
Sitting right in that chair where you are, I had a person from New Zealand. He is the chairman of the Central Council of New Zealand. Douglas Saunders is his name. And they are doing a lot of service there. One of the activities they have started recently is prison service in prisons where there are male prisoners. Till now they were doing prisons where there are female prisoners. And the prison authorities said, why don't you take on the males too? But they are tough guys. So these people pray a lot to Swami and then they go. And they are well received. And one day, when this group goes there, there's a Gujarati Sevadal, and he is carrying a picture of Swami like we all do, and it sort of was visible or it fell down or something like that. And this prisoner was a huge fellow, tattooed all over, a Maori. He says, hey, that fellow, he came to my cell, and he blessed. He raised his two arms. He didn't say bless. He raised his two arms like this, what we call a bahasta, and he simply vanished. You know him? What do you say to a fellow like that? Oh, there are many such stories.
It's, you know, really incredible, things that can happen.
I heard also a similar story from, not exactly a similar story, but a story where Swami made his presence felt. This happened in West Indies, one of the islands, probably Trinidad. And there was an African, person of African descent as opposed to Indians. You know, half of Trinidad is Indians. He was a rich man, but was in financial difficulties. He was driving his car, Mercedes, going very fast. He wanted to crash and die. Suddenly he heard a voice, come to Prashanti. He didn't know what the hell was happening. I mean, he never heard that word. And who is this calling? He couldn't see anybody. It was a lonely road. Three times he heard, he slowed down. I must find out. So he goes around asking, hey, have you ever heard of Prashanti? So finally he hit upon an Indian who was a devotee. He said, Prashanti? Of course, you know, where is it? It's in India, Prashanti Nilayam. How does one go there? So he comes here and he sees Baba. And I am told Swami gave him an interview and all that. And said, yes, it was I who saved you, and he went back. So these things happen all the time. And there are so many of these cases, we just don't know what's happening where. Okay, now let me ask you something more close to your profession. You started off as an ambitious young doctor, and you climbed way up almost to the top of Everest. Then one fine day, you came into the fold of Swami. Till that time, there was no place for spirituality in medicine. Doctor had to do his job, he had to save people, but that did not prevent him from making money, becoming famous or whatever. Now that you have come here, seen Swami, worked in this hospital, etc., what role do you see for spirituality in medicine? That's my first question. And do you feel, this is supplementary, that spirituality will play any role at all in medicine as practiced in America? Over to you.
So, in terms of spirituality in medicine, let me just give you some anecdotal experiences of my own.
Wonderful.
You know, we often have patients who come to us who are very sick. You know, that's kind of our niche market, so to speak. And it is amazing how many patients can come in. And they may be 85 years of age, and they may have two or three things wrong with them, and we spend an inordinate amount of time with operating on them. But there are some patients who just come and they'll say, listen, doctor, I know that you're just an instrument of God.
They say that to you?
Yes, absolutely. And they'll say that we believe in God and we believe in you. And we will pray to God to give you the power to take care of us.
That's wonderful.
And if, you know, we live, we live. And if we die, it's God's will. And I can tell you, I have yet to lose one of those patients. I mean, those patients just do remarkably well. On the flip side to that, we often have young 45-year-olds who may just need a little simple bypass surgery who come in and they will question everything, okay? They'll say, well, what is the exact complication rate for this? What is the exact problem with this? You know, how long am I going to be in the hospital? How much is this going to hurt? You know, and you try to steer them towards a little spirituality.
You have a lawyer by your side when you answer.
Absolutely. So they will hear nothing of the concept of, you know, leaving things into a higher being. And they uniformly will have every complication in the book.
Are they non-believers or believers, but they don't believe fully? Bit of both?
A bit of both. Mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, they are probably a combination. I mean, they may go to a church, but don't really believe in the church, but they just go for going sake, or they're on the fence, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Or they actually may be believers, but they don't have that belief that's strong enough that allows them to give up control when they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
So, through my own experience with patients, I think it makes a huge difference if someone is able to have the belief and the faith to give up control and realize that, you know, we're going to pray, but what will happen. And I would say that those patients do much better. So what I do is when I talk to patients, especially if it's a very difficult case, I will talk to them and get a feel of where they are in their spiritual path, if at all possible. In other words, I will bring up the concept of God. You know, they'll say, you know, things like, doctor, I hope you get a very good sleep the night before, or don't go out partying and don't get drunk, or something like that. And I will kind of jokingly say, I don't drink, number one, and I'll try to get rest. But a more powerful thing may be for you to just pray to God. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I would just throw out there. And a lot of times patients will take that upon themselves, and they'll say, oh, absolutely, you know, we know that you're just an instrument of God, or we'll pray a lot, we have a lot of faith in God. And if they do that, then you can take it down a little bit more of a spiritual path. Sometimes they'll just completely ignore that comment and go on and be much more secular, in which case then I don't push it. Because, you know, you clearly don't want to push it, and you know they may then think that you're different type of person,
yeah,
trying to convert them. So you have to play. What I do is I kind of look at the patient and their family and look at the direction that they're going. And according to the direction that we're going, we do have I would say a talk about the spiritual aspect of things. And I would say I do it with my patients about 50-60% of the time. And the other times, people don't want to hear about it all. I mean, they just want to know, you know, what stitches we're going to use, what valves we're going to use. But a fair number of people, and especially with people with large families, a lot of African Americans, for instance, who go to church, and they'll say, Alleluia, you know. And some of them actually, even in the morning, will insist that before the patient goes for surgery, you know, we all hold hands and we'll have a little prayer. And
the patients insist on that.
Yes. Yeah, I have not insisted on prayer yet because, you know, each person is different, right? You don't have Christians, you don't have Jewish people and stuff. So I stay out of that. But they will, insist that, you know, we all stick around and hold our hands. And although that's difficult for me because in the morning time is my busiest time, but I make sure that the nurses know not to put him to sleep till I come there. And then, you know, I think it's very important for the family because the family is going through an extremely high period of stress. I mean, the patient is asleep. I mean, he doesn't know what's going on, but the family is the one that's stressed the most. So we try to help the family as much as we can.
Question on demographics and gender. Among the patients who believe in God, is it more women than men, or is it 50-50? That's my first question.
I would say that it's more females than males. At least they are able to vocalize their belief in God and that they have faith. I suspect that a lot of males might, but a lot of the males might be too macho or afraid to express their feelings.
And the second question, is there any age group where this faith is more prominent?
Yeah, I would say clearly the older the patients are, they have much more faith. I would say, after about 60 to 70 years of age, the faith is much higher.
And you see more of this faith in amongst Latinos and Afro-Americans rather than the...
Now, you have to, at the University of Chicago, where we're at, we're in the south side of Chicago, which is predominantly African-American.
That's right.
And if I had to compare African-Americans with Caucasian, I would say that the faith and the belief is much more in the African-Americans, at least that they can vocalize it. And they are often the ones who say, you know, we're very happy that you believe in this, and so would you mind coming and praying with us before the surgery? Mm-hmm. And then they will sing a hymn, or they'll sing a prayer, or they'll have their pastor or their reverend come there. I would say Caucasians generally are not as forthcoming with their faith, but a lot of them are very, very...
Even Catholics?
Yeah, they don't express it as much. But I think that once they soften up, or once you talk to them a little bit, they may not want to hold your hands and pray, but they do understand that there is a, you know, there's a power that's greater than us all.
You pray silently, I presume.
Well, before every case, I will, you know, we go to the scrub skin to kind of clean our hands, and that's a good time for me to do Gayatri Mantra.
Oh, and, wonderful.
You know, Swami has blessed me with, you know, rings. And I've told Swami, you know, I can't wear the rings because I have to take them off to scrub all the time. So I put them as a necklace. Mm-hmm. So it's actually right in my sternum. So, you know, you often can just touch it and you can get the power of Swami. So I do a pray. And then...
I would call it a close call. You're close to the heart.
Yes, absolutely. And... yeah, you don't know how many times, like, when you're operating or something and your mind starts deviating, and, you know, it's amazing how many times this ring will catch one of the hair follicles in my chest and just pull on it, and all of a sudden you wake up and you realize it's Swami's calling card. But, yeah, we do, I say a silent prayer, and then while operating, I mean, obviously you have to interact with the team and do everything, but, you know, when things get a little bit dicey or a little bit tough, then I'm saying my Om Sai Rams. And so I think it's, you know, it's very important. I feel comfortable saying that.
Coming to a sort of a more general question, you have seen the power of spirituality, and there are pockets in America where people not only believe, even doctors believe and they practice it and so forth. But in terms of practicing medicine, will the doctors eventually, or should I say America eventually, turn towards higher being, faith in a higher being, or it will remain substantially materialistic for decades to come? In other words, we hear a lot about public, America became being very religious and all that. And this is a profession where you heal a patient. You give him back his life when he's battling for life, if you're lucky. And it's a profession that has its origins in compassion and love. Will those feelings come back to the profession in America, not on an individual basis, but on a collective basis?
I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, America is interesting. You know, there are a lot of people that go to Sunday school, and they are religious people in one hand. And in the other hand, the founding fathers of America had made it very clear that you have must keep religion out of government and politics. Okay?
But they didn't say out of medicine.
Not out of medicine, but I think what happens, like in our institution, for example, okay, we had a discussion about this with the CEO of the hospital, and one of the things that they're very afraid about is that if you talk about spirituality and God, then they're afraid that you're starting to preach people and that you're trying to convert people. So even in Catholic institutions, they're really not allowed to bring up the concept of religion because they're afraid that they will be perceived as people trying to convert others. On the other hand, if the patient brings it up, then there are mechanisms within our institution. For example, we have a rabbi priest, we have Catholic, we have Islamic clerics, and we actually even have a Hindu priest who is on a pager call if somebody needs to come in. So if the patient initiates it, I think the institution will support it, but I don't think the institution itself will initiate the concept or the talk of spirituality.
But, you know, when I talk of spirituality, I don't mean it in the sense of religion. I mean it in terms of love and compassion, as Swami tells us. I mean it in terms of, you know, helping people who cannot afford and things like that. Offer the fruits of medicine, the power of medicine to those who are not in a position to pay for it. It's in that sense that I'm talking about.
Well, I think that is one of the, you know, the most amazing things about Swami's hospitals, right? Both in Bangalore and Whitefield and in Puttaparthi, is that you have the most unfortunate people, very poor, amazingly poor. I mean, one time we had brought in homograft valves, which are valves that actually come from cadavers and very expensive. In the United States, each one of these valves costs about $10,000. And the company had just happened to have some valves that were of odd sizes that people didn't want. And so they said, well, you're going to go to India. How about using homografts? So homografts are very good valves because the patients don't need to have to take anticoagulation. Mm-hmm. And the incidence of stroke and clotting of the valves after surgery is very low. So here, you know, we had gotten all these valves that were very expensive, and we brought them here, you know, to operate in Whitefield and in Puttaparthi. And knowing that, you know, they had sent telegrams out to about 400 people. Mm-hmm. And many, many people just didn't show up because they didn't have the
money
to travel. And so that's how poor these patients are. And to get the treatment that they get, which is really the state-of-the-art valves, I mean, they get better valves here than they get in a lot of the for-profit institutions in India. The technology is amazing. And more amazing than that is the people who deliver the technology, right? You have physicians here who are dedicated to Swami, who are dedicated to these, taking care of these patients with amazing compassion, and who, you know, obviously aren't doing this for the money. I mean, they're not being paid great amounts of money, but they do it out of pure love. So I think Swami's hospital is on one extreme, a good extreme. So in the United States, you know, even in my practice, if you look at it, I mean, you have to balance, unfortunately, the economic things about time. I mean, I would love to sit down with the patient and talk to them for an hour and find out the intricacies of their life and, you know, what makes them tick, and that way you can make them better. I think a lot of patients just feel better by talking to them. Even instead of operation or medicine, probably just talking to them makes a lot of them better. So in terms of giving care for people who don't have the means, the United States is a unique environment, because if a patient comes to the emergency room, and even if they have no insurance, okay, we are mandated and obligated to take care of them to the best of our ability.
Is that right?
They have no money at all. So if they come to the emergency room and they're very sick, let's say they've had a huge heart attack or they've had a stroke or something like that, they will get state-of-the-art best care. Mm-hmm. And that is mandated by the state. And actually, for me, that's fantastic, right? Because somebody comes in the doorstep, I don't have to say no, right? They come into the emergency room, and the hospital can't come to me and say, well, you know, this is going to cost a lot of money, because they're mandated to take care of them. So this allows me the opportunity to take care of anybody I want. I think the time people get into trouble in the United States is for elective operations where they don't come into the emergency room, and then they have to go find a doctor. So let's say somebody has a cold and they don't have any insurance, then you have to find a doctor. That doctor is going to charge you $80 or $100, and you may or may not have it. And then simple medications, sometimes antibiotics, end up costing a lot of money. And so you have extremes. If somebody's extremely ill, they get extremely good care. If somebody needs routine medication, like for blood pressure checking, then, and if they don't have insurance or don't have the means, then they get suboptimal care. So I think the extreme end is okay. I think what they need to do is establish a method to take care of the not so extremely ill before they get extremely ill. And so towards that goal, what we have done in our institution, so our institution is very interesting. It's a world-class, we call it the forefront of medicine. So a lot of the technology we have is like a generation ahead of everybody else's technology. Yet, although we're a university setting, we also reside in probably one of the poorest areas mm-hmm. of the country. And so we take care of a lot of patients who are underinsured or uninsured completely. And a lot of the reasons patients get very sick is because they don't see a doctor in time. So what we have done with our head of community affairs is go out to all the churches, and now we're giving talks in churches. And we're also partnering with a lot of physicians who are actually paid by the state to take care of underinsured people, but people don't know that they exist. So what happens is if somebody gets sick, they call us. And they call us, and then they get sucked into a huge environment where nobody knows what's happened to them. So what we have done, and the institution has supported this, is through our cardiothoracic surgery section, which is weird because we're supposed to be a very high-end section, yet we're taking care of diabetes and hypertension. If somebody calls us and they say, well, we're not feeling well, what we do is we have established about 150 partners, which are physicians out in the community who take care of general medicine. And we will then put the patient with the right partner that we have. And so that partner can take care of their general needs. And a lot of the partners have, you know, they're subsidized by the state to take care of patients like this. So the patients are happy because they can call us and we can get them care. We may not be able to deliver the care ourselves, but we can get them the care. And for them, that builds up trust in them with us. And that's actually becoming a very, very powerful way to manage the community that needs to have healthcare managed. And hopefully, we're hoping that that type of model can be propagated throughout throughout the medical enterprise, because there is care available. People just don't know where to go to get the care. And that's the saddest part.
You come here almost once a year, if not more. Do your colleagues in your hospital know where you're going and why you're going?
Yeah, actually, you know, there was an article in Chicago Magazine, and that person came and talked to me, and when he came to my office, he saw Swami's picture, and he said, you know, who's Swami? And so I was a little hesitant because I didn't want to appear to be some kind of religious zealot. But I did talk to him about Swami, and then I gave him books about the hospital and everything. So he actually, when he wrote this article, talked about me doing volunteer work at Puttaparthi and everything. So people in the hospital got to know about it. So they would always ask, you know, oh, when I tell them I'm going for a week, usually if I'm going for a week, they'll say, oh, you're going to go to work in the hospital. So to the point where now if they know I'm going, our hospital administration is very, very free about, you know, letting me use all the instruments that I could take or equipment. And, you know,
you're very supportive.
Very supportive, yeah. And we have a lot of vendors, you know, who will call me up and I say, oh, and I call Karen, your secretary, and she tells me that you're going to go to India in, you know, in August. And what do you want?
Oh,
so it's that stage. I don't have to ask anymore. It's like Swami almost gives it to my doorstep. And
Almost. He is giving it to you.
Yes, yes. And the other thing is, you know, I've been fortunate enough that in our section, we have about six surgeons, of which five actually go and do volunteer work in other places. Like, you know, one goes to Guatemala, one goes to Latin America, and some go to Africa. So, you know, we are trying to create a section that looks at volunteer work. And we propagate that by giving them the time off. So that the 1 week that they have off to go do whatever they need to do doesn't count as vacation time. So we all chip in to take care of home territory, just like I'm here for a week now. So a lot of people are chipping in because I'm away. So by creating that type of team atmosphere, and they go to do volunteer work so that they understand what volunteer work is about. So I think from at least from our section point of view, it's very, very supportive.
One last question. And this is, Swami has been doing some amazing, breathtaking work for so many years, more than a dozen years, at least in Puttaparthi. So much has been done, but so little is known about it. Now and then people write. I mean, by any standard, this is an incredible thing. I mean, out in the middle of nowhere, in an absolute God-forsaken village, except that God is living in the village. I mean, as doctors say, when they started the hospital 13 years ago, if you want a cup of tea outside, you couldn't go get it because there were just a couple of huts that belonged to washermen. And I've seen it in those days. But yet it has done something remarkable. How come it is not well known at all? I mean, this is a great story, one of the greatest stories in the history of medicine. Why is it not?
Well, I think some of it is the hospital administration and directed by Swami are kind of controlling how much of it is known, because there's
no, that's all right. It's a low profile, but the news sounds always have a nose for news.
Yeah.
How come they are not knowing about it? That's what I'm asking. Of course, from our side, there's a self-imposed reticence. We don't like to talk about it because people might think that we are seeking publicity.
Well, I'll tell you what type of things are happening in the United States. Actually, in August, Dr. Goldstein had come to our center in Chicago, and they said they wanted to have a public meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was the first time in Chicago that they talk about having a public meeting for Swami. Usually when they have public meetings, all Swami devotees go there.
I know.
So it's not like it's not exposing new people to it. So this was specifically designed to bring new people. And so to do that, we wanted to, advertise. But you can't just advertise in the newspaper. So what we did was, in the United States, they have a thing called public access channels. So these are TV slots that they have to play if you give them a videotape, for instance. They'll play it for half an hour on TV. So what the organizers decided to do was to have a TV talk show about Swami.
Mm-hmm.
And then put it on this public access and to try to draw people to the public forum.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just did that. I think that was done in the springtime. And one of the nice things is we didn't want to talk about Hinduism. We don't want to talk about a particular religion. We want to emphasize the fact that Swami is here. Swami talks about unity of religion. And that Swami's main message is compassion and love. So how do you talk about compassion and love? So we talk about a lot of Swami's service projects, because that's what people can relate to. And I was lucky enough to be on the panel and talk about Swami's hospital, and somebody else talked about Swami's teachings and education, and somebody else talked about medical camps and the water project and everything. So all of Swami's miracles allow us to present Swami and the Satya Sai organization as a humanitarian organization. And then when people get drawn in because of that, then they will then start saying, they read some books, and then they can talk about Swami as a God. But if you start talking about Swami as a God on TV, then they'll just turn off.
Actually, Swami doesn't expect to be talked about as God. In fact, he tells many people, you don't have to tell them about me, but tell them about my work.
Yes.
I will make myself known to them when the time is ripe. That's what he said.
And you know, the most amazing thing is, so this goes on a very remote TV channel, and it's aired like four times in a month, right? So it's not like it is prime time. And about four people called me up before I came, and they said, oh yeah, I saw you on PAX TV. I'm like, okay, now how can that happen? You know what I mean? Look at the statistical probability of somebody just windsurfing. So a lot of people have seen it. And it has piqued the interest of a lot of people. A lot of it is because of the volunteer work and all the great service projects of Swami. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the public forum. But I don't know how successful it's been. But I expect with Swami's grace, it was quite successful.
I'm sure, because we have videotapes of many of these things held in different parts of the world. And we can see big crowds.
You know, I would say the amazing thing is, you know, you're saying that the message is not being propagated, and I would disagree with that.
Not saying the message is not being propagated. I'm saying, are people, mainstream people in America, becoming aware of it?
You would be amazed how many people are actually aware of Swami.
Is that right?
And have heard about him, or have read about him passing by.
No, and particularly in the medical profession, because, you know, in the world of medicine, this is something unique.
Yeah.
So I'm just asking, if you take AME, how many people there know about Swami?
Yeah, probably like that. Yeah, I guess what I would say is we don't know how many people know. You know, for instance, just before I came, a cardiologist called me up and I said, hey, I saw you about that, and I know about, Sai Baba, and do you have a Satya Sai organization in Chicago? I mean, he was a cardiologist. He's an African-American cardiologist.
Mm.
So I think it's amazing how many people there are that know about Swami.
And we don't know about that.
We don't know about that.
Okay. So when are you leaving?
I'll be leaving tomorrow morning.
Okay. I wish you good luck and a safe journey back home, and hope to see you here back soon. And I hope you'll bring with you lots of stories, because that's what we have to dish out to our listeners. God be with you. Thank you. Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
You were listening to a conversation with Dr. Valluvan Jeevanandam. In conversation with him was Professor G. Venkatraman. This came to you from the studios of Radio Sai. Tune in to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo. Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo.
Soham
Sai, dhyan.
करो
सोहम साई ध्यान करो
सोहम आत्मा शिव परमात्मा सद्गुरु ब्रह्म सनातन हे के सद्गुरु ब्रह्म सनातन हे परम दया घन पावन हे परम दया घन पावन हे जन्म ज दुख विनाशन हे जन्म ज दुख विनाशन हे भय
ಧಾರಣೆ ಗುರು ಬ್ರಹ್ಮ ಸನಾತನ ಹೇ
ಮನಸಾ Thank you. श्यामगोपाला रहे साई गोपाला, गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला, देवकी नंदन श्याम गोपाला, गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला, केशव माधव श्याम गोपाला, साई गोपाला, गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला।
श्रीरामम्
తస్మరణం శ్రీరామం ఆనందదాయక శ్రీరామం
ఆనందదాయక శ్రీరామం
మోక్షప్రదాయక శ్రీరామం
మోక్షప్రదాయక శ్రీరామం
భజ మనసాయి రామం రామం జమన సాయి రామం రామం
జమన సాయి రామం రామం
ప్రాతస్మరణం శ్రీరామం.